It went straight down the middle. Then it started to hook.
Welcome to another edition of For the Good of the Game. And Bruce Devlin, this morning we have a gem of a guest, a tough competitor, multifaceted woman, and a sparkly personality.
Well, how about a couple of facts? 59 cuts made in majors out of 62 appearances. Two-time major champion, Nabisco Dinosaur in 1992 and 1999. Everybody knows who I'm talking about, I'm sure. We see her every week just about on the CBS telecast, and it is great to have you, Dottie Pepper. Thanks for joining Mike and myself this morning.
Well, thanks for having me. This is quite an illustrious group of people you've assembled and will continue to assemble well past my appearance. It's pretty amazing what you're doing.
Well, thank you. We've enjoyed it. It's been fun. We're so glad that we can add all the great lady players along with the men that we've already discussed. So thanks again for being here.
Yeah, Dottie, thanks for being with us. And we are having a blast telling the lady stories. Of course, you and I talked a little bit, and we've done Kathy Whitworth now, and we had a chance to do Laura Davies. This week we just did Sally Little and Martha Nowsey. And so we're looking forward to continuing to build on that list of great players from the LPGA days. And, you know, while we talk about your career, I'm sure we'll talk a little bit about the LPGA history, some of the great players that you competed with back in the times that you were active on tour. What we like to do in telling your story is always start at the beginning. So tell us a little bit about growing up as a young lady and how you came to learn the game then, too.
Well, I grew up in upstate New York, where I still live. I left for warmer climates when I was actively playing, but moved back home, I guess, about 13 years ago. Family. My grandmother on my dad's side introduced me to the game. She had become a very avid player. I think she was about an 8 handicap at her best. And the oldest grandchild it was a cool thing to have us be able to share that time. So I started with a series of 5 lessons from a journeyman professional at a driving range here in Saratoga Springs with a set of clubs that were bought from the local sporting goods store, Chichi Rodriguez, Northwestern. And it had, of all things in it, I've told this story so many times, but who in the world would now put a 3-iron in a kid's starter set? A 3-iron in it. So I guess I learned the art of hitting long irons from my early age. But you know, we played at a golf. We started on a 9-hole golf course. It's still there. It's par 29 in the state park system here in New York State. And I played a lot of golf just in this area. I didn't have a family that had the means to haul me all over the place playing big tournaments. So I was really a product of really local ladies' leagues that I could play in because they were close. So it wasn't a Silver Spoon junior golf career, let's put it that way. But my dad owned a driving range for a while after he got out of the insurance business post being in baseball. And I worked the range. I was the kid in the cage that everybody trying to bomb balls at and cleaned toilets, made hot dogs. I did it all. And that's where I ended up, I think, really kind of fine-tuning my game through my mentor, George Pulver. He was retired from the facilities that he was professional at, but he still came up and gave lessons now and again there. And I was fortunate to be on a very short list of people that he was still working with.
Yeah, well, tell us a little bit more about that. And, of course, we wanted to talk about your book anyway, your new book entitled A Letter to a Future Champion, My Time with Mr. Pulver, who you just referenced. And I'm sure you're busy with the book signings, and there's a lot of activity around that book launch. But tell us a little bit about how that relationship developed and just how meaningful he was in your early life.
Well, it developed, I think, with a twofold beginning to the relationship, because he was a golf course architect at that golf course that my grandmother and I played the most of our golf at that time. It was $100 for a junior golf membership for an entire season. And to this day, it's still only $200. So we kind of through the town that now owns a golf course, I've been able to keep that alive and keep golf affordable for kids in this area. So that was really important. But I knew him from building Brookhaven Golf Club. I played a little bit of those local ladies leagues golf against his wife, Martha. And when it got to the point in my career where my dad couldn't really take me much much farther down the road with what he knew about the game. It was kind of a common sense no-brainer to reach out to Mr. Pulver, but I was so chicken that I wrote a letter to his daughter, asked her if she thought it would be something that he might be interested in, because he was 81 and I was 15 at the time.
Yeah.
Amazing. Yeah.
Did you play other sports as well?
I skied during the winter. My family is still deeply entrenched in the ski business, so I spent all winter on snow. Didn't play any other competitive sports in high school because it was just, there wasn't any time. I worked in the ski shop and I had in golf season, I wanted to be able to play both sides. And it actually worked out because we played on the boys team here in high school. But the season was in the fall, but the state championship was in the spring. So if you're playing another sport, you were kind of cooked if you made it to states.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Bruce and I, having had a chance now to do several of these interviews, most of the folks that we've talked to, they certainly did play other sports as youngsters. But as we talk to the women, it's interesting, particularly the American women, there's sort of a line of demarcation with Title IX. And so you came along after Title IX, which meant that there were probably more, maybe not equal, but more opportunities for women to compete on a team at a university or at a high school compared to, you know, earlier on, we talked to some of the women that came before Title IX. So I was just curious as to what sort of opportunities existed for you back in high school and college days.
So we did not have a girls team, but that's not really a Title IX situation. That's a state funding situation and interest level here in New York State. We finally do. This is the third year that they've had a team at my high school. And our section finally hosted the state championship last week. But it wasn't a big thing for me because Furman University had a women's golf program and a well-established women's golf program. What has changed since is that there are a lot more programs available. Even schools like Vanderbilt didn't have a women's golf program when I was in school. And Clemson is very new to the women's game. It's still inside 10 years of having a program there. So it's changed a lot more just after but it really didn't. It didn't affect me too much because Furman had such a well-established, long-running program.
So did you say that you played on the boys' team then in high school?
I did. I played 5 years on the boys' team.
And how well accepted were you from the boys?
They didn't have a choice. I still stay in touch with a couple of my teammates. I give an award at the high school for both boys and girls. Every year for the most outstanding player, and not necessarily the most outstanding player, but the most valuable player to the entire team. Didn't have to necessarily be the best player on the team.
I imagine that you were probably the best player on the team, actually.
I played in the one spot for my last 3 years, Bruce.
I figured you did, yeah.
And I actually qualified to go to the state championship, so you had to play from the tees, and everybody played from the same tees, qualified to go to the state championship, so it was 98 guys and me at Cornell.
Oh, isn't that amazing?
Yep.
That's a great story.
So at some point, you got thinking about, well, maybe I want to play this in college. Were you highly recruited as a high school senior?
I had a fair amount of letters. I only made two trips. I knew I wanted to go south of the Mason-Dixon line. So when I got a letter from Penn State, it went in the circular file. I wanted to go south. Hitting golf balls downstairs in the basement during the winter, but knew I needed to get out of the Northeast in order to play better. But the big mandate for me, for my parents, was you go somewhere, you get a valuable education, because no one had a four-year education in my family up to that point. And Dad leaving baseball in the way he did with not much to fall back on was difficult. So getting a valued education. So it was important to be prepared with a really valuable degree. But I was probably, I don't know, I visited TCU, who won the national championship. Chris Cheddar ended up getting my scholarship there. When I said no, I was going to go wear purple for another school, for Furman, Chris took my scholarship, and she ended up winning on the LPGA Tour as well. So it really just came down to two schools and two really good educations, but I felt like Furman was a little bit closer to home. It was only 900 miles away. Had a golf course on campus, which was really important. The heritage behind the program was really important when you look at players like Bessie King and Beth Daniel and Sherry Turner, all major champions, had come out of there. That was a big part of why I chose where I chose.
While at Furman, Dottie, you were 3-time All-American there too, so you were a pretty dominant player in college as well.
It was a very bumpy start, Bruce. I was not very good. My freshman first term, it was pretty ugly, but I spent a week with my grandmother over spring break, and I did nothing but beat balls and play golf in Melbourne in Florida, and something clicked and ended up finishing, had a chance to win the national championship as a freshman, actually. And it was pretty good from there, for the most part.
Yeah. Was it something you picked up on yourself, or was there something that somebody noticed that was helping you as you beat all those balls?
It was something that clicked from one of Mr. Pulver's letters. And I had that whole week with no pressure of school, no pressure of anything else but going down there and beating balls. And a girl from my geology class gave me a ride. She lived in the next town over, so it worked out really well.
Oh, yeah, amazing. It's amazing how things turn.
You had a little bit of amateur success even before you got to Furman, didn't you?
I did. I played in the state tournaments on a regular basis because the rule was if I could drive, I could play. That was kind of what we had money for, and you stayed with a local family generally. I won the state girls twice, 81 and 83, and then the state women's amateur at age 15 and 81. That was a pretty big deal because I won the amateur before I won the junior, so there was a lot of pressure to win the junior. After coming off of a win, three weeks earlier or so.
And then did you play in the U.S. Open then while you were at Furman when you were low am?
I did. That was 84. So that was my first crack at it. I qualified at Apawamis, which just made me – I just still love that golf course. My sister caddied for me. It was just kind of – I'm very lucky that the U.S. Open was coming to a regionally. It was in Boston or Peabody, North Shore, and went down to Apawamis to qualify and actually had the women's Western was the next week at Yale. So it was a huge, or in New Haven, it was a huge run up the East Coast of really good golf at that time.
Yeah, I think that was Hollis Stacey's third win in a U.S. Open. Tell us a little bit about that U.S. Open experience.
Still one of my... If I had one round of golf left to play, I would play. I would pick Salem. It was my first total immersion in really understanding Ross golf. Mr. Pulver kind of primed me for it, what to expect. And he was right on every instance. But it was a week that really changed my life because it opened up all the doors for bigger amateur events. And it put me on the map to be on the Curtis Cup team in 86, which was the foundation really for my passion for the Solheim Cup. So that's... That was a huge week for me.
Hear that? That's the sound of a walk-off albatross, a 2 on a par 5 to win a 2-day golf tournament. That shot happened to me, 1 in 600 million odds. Since then, people call me Albie. Now, I've told this story so often, my friends can't take it. I'm pretty sure my wife, next time I tell her, she's going to leave me. So I decided to start a podcast to tell the entire world about it because it deserves it. It's the craziest shot you've never heard of. And guess what? There's tons more stories like this all around golf. And that's what our podcast is all about. Join me and my fellow degenerates, Panda and Shepherd, as we dive into them. Insane bets, crazy what-if scenarios, and all the you-had-to-be-there type moments in golf. Find us wherever you get your podcasts. Did I Tell You About My Albatross?
Curtis Cup, of course, was at Prairie Dunes, I believe, in 1986.
Mm-hmm. It was.
Who were the captains back then?
Oh, man. Judy Bell was the American captain, and... I can't remember who was the captain of the GBNI side.
Well, it must have been a pretty tough competition.
Well, no, we were vastly unprepared. We had a team that had no one had played in the past in a Curtis Cup. I think there was a general feeling that we had a bunch of college rock stars that they would roll over the GBNI. And I think our team never really appreciated what the Curtis Cup meant. Now in hindsight, I was so honored to be able to go down to Mountain Lake in January, this January, to spend a couple of days with the team that just played so remarkably well at Marion. And just kind of pass along some of those stories of things that I learned and appreciated. And it was just so different from when we played in 86.
Yeah. Just looking back on your college career, what are some of more fond memories of that experience?
I don't know if you could call it fond, but we lost the national championship by a shot my senior year, and it was actually graduation day. So we had four seniors and a sophomore on the team, and there was no scoreboards at that time. And we came in with a very, very strong team. And I remember my teammates were University of New Mexico playing their golf course in Albuquerque. And my teammates and coach were all in the back left corner, par five finishing hole. And I hit on the green in three, 10 feet right of the hole. And all I see them is, you got to make it. Got to make it. So I'm thinking we had to make it to tie, and we had calculated wrong. I made the putt, and we lost by one.
Shame.
Yeah, but that was – so it was the highs and lows of graduation day. I suppose we all graduated, but we lost. That was a sad night.
Yeah, I'll bet.
Yeah, but you know what? You're on that green thinking you've got to make that putt. It really means something. You made it. There had to be some good takeaways from that experience.
There definitely were. I had a good championship myself. After I opened with 81, I was so sick the night before the opening round. And coach asked me you don't have to play tomorrow. It might be better off if you don't play because we might have to take your score. And it turned out that I don't remember if they took my score or not, but I rebounded well enough to finish, I think, top five myself, and the team, like I said, we only lost by a shot.
Yeah.
So when did you start thinking about maybe I'll do this for a living?
I was probably 15.
Not young, huh?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, I wanted to play professional golf, but like I said, the mandate from my parents was to make sure I had a backup plan, and that was handled at Furman. I wanted to play the professional golf. And, you hit putt after putt after putt to win the U.S. Open, to win the LPGA Championship, to make it on tour. I mean, all those putts that are situational, that fortunately I had ability to do a lot of that.
So what did you do then between graduation and joining the LPGA Tour in 1988? There must have been a little bit of time in between there.
I played mini tour. I played what was then the Futures Tour. Had a little bit of money socked aside from my grandmother. I gave up my amateur qualifying exemption to go to the Open. So I got back into the U.S. Open with $5,000 in my pocket that I borrowed from my grandfather on my mom's side, because the money I had set aside was in a CD and I couldn't touch it until August. So I borrowed $5,000 from him, thinking I can play these next 6-7 weeks on $5,000 and see what I make. And so he cut me a check. I put it in the bank. I paid for qualifying school entry. I got myself through. I paid for the U.S. Open entry. And I finished, I think, tied 12th or tied 13th at the Open itself. Then I walked back in 2 weeks later and handed him the $5,000 back. And I had enough money to get through August. It was kind of scratch and go at the beginning, trying to have enough money to get through. But I think the hardest realization for me was getting my card in late October of 87. And realizing I only had enough money to get through half the year. I only had $30,000 and it was going to cost about $60,000 to play. So I had to play hard.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, let's just for our listeners do a brief recap of the career of Dottie Pepper. As we mentioned, turning professional in 1988 at age 23, 25 professional wins for Dottie, including 17 victories on the LPGA Tour, leading money winner in 92, as well as player of the year in 92 and the Vera Trophy winner, top 10 money in 10 of the 11 years, Bruce, from 1991 to 2001. That's pretty good playing right there.
Yeah, and as I mentioned earlier, to make 59 cuts out of 62 major championship starts, it's a pretty powerful record.
It sure is. You mentioned the two majors that Dottie has, the 1992 and 1999 Nabisco Dinosaur. We're going to talk about those, but Dottie, we thought we'd have you take us down memory lane with some of your other key victories throughout your career. And I think I probably want to start with something you won in Albany in 1985 as an amateur.
Yeah, I won on the Futures Tour, the Albany Colony Open. And it's still on what's now, or what are they calling it now? I forget what they call it now. Anyway, that tour is still very much alive, and it's one of the longest running events that's there. It's now at Pine Haven Country Club, just near Albany. And thought I had a putt at the last hole to tie, and it turned out to be a win. My sister, again, caddying for me. But I won on that tour as an amateur. And I don't know if anyone has since, but that was a big deal, too, because it really, for me, it validated being low amateur in the open. It also showed me that I could have some success, even if it's a mid-start on a smaller tour, that I was kind of on the right path.
Yeah. But it didn't take you long once you turned pro in 88 to notch your first victory in January in 89, Oldsmobile LPGA Classic. And you beat a real, real dog of a player there, mm-hmm. Beth Daniel. I mean, goodness gracious, that had to be great feeling to beat her.
The last three ball was Lopez, myself, and Beth. And I bogeyed the last hole to let the even have the playoff begin. Nancy looked out for birdie, and then we ran out of daylight, so I had to come back on Monday to finish. So I was sleepless.
So what did that one feel like, getting that first one under your belt?
I had a very good 88 on tour. It was a year of amazing young players coming out on the tour for their first season. It was Laura Davies, Daniela Macapani, Lieselotte Neumann, myself. There were a lot of really good players that season. And I think I finished 22nd on the money list or something like that, and I was third in the Rookie of the Year running. So it was wow. it was a really hard year to come out as a rookie. So to get a win quickly in 89 was important. And then all of a sudden I thought I'd never hit a bad golf shot again in my life. I went on the LPGA Tour, so you know, I'm golden. And I think I missed three of the next four cuts or something like that. It was ugly.
It's amazing.
I'm sure you'll agree, and our other guests have shared this with us as well. Two things. One, you use the term validation. We've heard that a lot.
Is that right?
You know, we've heard it an awful lot. We just heard it yesterday, didn't we, Bruce?
Yeah, we sure did.
You know, you get that, for example, Martha Nowsey talking about winning. Well, her first win was a Stableford competition.
Right.
Everybody sort of discounted that, right?
Sure.
The next win was the Sun-Times event in Chicago.
She pulled out of the last hole.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. But, you know, people sort of discounted that win because it was sort of a short field. Mm-hmm. So to get that third win in the Du Maurier, validation. We've had a lot of players talk about, particularly win number two, validation of that first victory.
Yeah, it's very true. And I'm not so sure why, but I think maybe you think you got a little lucky, or maybe there was an accident along the way that you kind of stumbled over instead of gotten mowed over by. And it was important to get a second win and not have to wait a very long time to get it.
Yeah, so your validation came at the Crestar Classic at Greenbrier Country Club by 9 over Chris Johnson. Boy, that was just just squeaked in there, huh?
Yeah, I wanted to lay up on the last hole. I literally wanted to hit 3 wood off the tee, and I was like, no, what are you? You got to be an idiot to hit 3 wood off the tee if you got an 8-shot lead or whatever. And I did burn the last hole to get it to 9, but it was only 54 holes. So I just.
Yeah, wow.
I had come back from playing in the LPGA Pro-Am at Furman the week before, and again, something clicked. It was my getting my left heel down on the ground to initiate a downswing. I remember it clear as can be. That's what set it apart. And I think I shot like 64 or 65 in the Pro-Am and just went on a tear.
How long did that last?
How long did it last? I mean, that was all right. That lasted... Or 90 was all right. I think it lasted. Well, it got U.S. Open and nearly won the Open from coming back from on the other side of the golf course. We had huge rain delays in Atlanta, through the Women's Open. And Terry Jastrow, Bruce, I'm sure you know Terry from yep. the ABC days.
Sure. Yep.
They had to be on the plane on Monday to go cover the Open Championship. And sure enough, I'm on the back nine finishing at Atlanta Country Club, and I'm six under. And if I hole out on the last hole, they're staying because it's going to be an 18-hole playoff on Monday. And he said, I went from loving you to hating you in 2 seconds. But I shot 66 on the other side of the golf course and nearly won the Open.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about that first major. 1992, Nabisco Dinosaur at Mission Hills in a playoff with Julie Inkster.
Yep. I had to make a putt at the last to win. She had left her birdie putt short to even give me a chance, and I buried it. And then Julie hit a poor tee shot at the 10th hole. Playoff went to 10. And the hole was cut back right. I hit it in the middle of the green and two-putted for a win. It was – again, I don't think that second major to me was validation of 92. But to win there against – who I beat in the playoff on the golf course with such solid history, and having it be the first major of the year, I think it set the year up to be very successful.
Yeah.
I think you'd finished second there the previous year, hadn't you?
I think that's probably right.
Yeah.
I know that was an important event, not only because it was a major, but it was my first major as an LPGA member. I got in the day before in 88 because I'd finished second in Phoenix. Ohiku made a birdie putt at the last to beat me in Phoenix as a rookie, and went over there and had no clue. It didn't have a place to stay, nothing, and ended up finishing in the top 10, and it rolled right through. It was a good golf course for me. It required that you hit a lot of different shots and you have a kind of a recovery pattern.
Yeah, somewhere in our research, I remember reading something about that final round where someone had shouted out "loser" to you after leaving a putt short on the 17th hole, maybe in the final round.
That's
what was that all about? Huh?
Some guy who probably been overserved in the gallery.
Yeah,
but I heard
probably had a little,
and I took it personally.
Yeah, I mean that kind of stuff does sort of impact you.
Yeah, I don't. How could it not? I mean, that was personal. Yeah,
got you fired up.
Mm-hmm. Very much so.
Why not?
Yeah, so birdied the last hole and went on to win on one more hole and not have to take the traditional, what's now become traditional, dive because I won on the landlocked 10th and they had to get off the air. So got the trophy from Dinah and the chairman of Nabisco at the time, and on we went.
That was a great start to 92, win there at Nabisco. Then you won three more times in 92. Seeger Women's Championship, Welsh Classic, and the Sun-Times Challenge. And you beat you beat a lot of really good players to win that four times in 92.
Well, Bruce, I think I played at a time when there were a lot of good players playing. And
yeah.
I played at a time, even my first Dinah, I was paired with Louise Suggs, but she still had a lifetime exemption into the event, and I played with Louise Suggs. Kathy Whitworth, I played with the first couple of years. She is my first Solheim Cup captain, and Lopez and Bradley and Sheehan and King and Daniel and just on and on and on. And I was thinking about it earlier this morning that I played at a time where, yes, I played with Louise Suggs, and I played all the way through Lorena Ochoa playing some of her very best golf. So it was a long time and a lot of really good players.
Yeah, I'll say there were
a lot of Hall of Famers from that era. What? Just tell us a little bit about some of the LPGA founders that you had a chance to get to know at some point during your career.
I think the one I was closest to was Marilyn Smith, and it was at that very first Dinah that she came up to me as a rookie and said, "Welcome." Welcome to the tour. We're so excited to have you. Your enthusiasm, you're a great player. And if there's anything I can ever do for you to just reach out. And she was amazing. Like I said, being able to reach out to people like Louise Suggs, Patty Berg, all those players that did so much to, they just did so much just to even get the game off the ground and to establish Absolutely. It the way they did, and do everything from writing their own press releases to pounding stakes to being around Betsy Rolls, tournament director of the LPGA Championship when I was playing. Those are the people that set the tour in such a positive motion for so long. And then to have relationships with people like Judy Rankin and play for Pat Bradley, play with Pat Bradley, play for Pat Bradley. It was a very special time. I think those 13 women are only one is now left, Marlene Hagee. I think they're just about the most underappreciated people that there are in the game.
Yeah. Very good point.
I think they each deserve a book in and of themselves. They've all got great, great stories. I remember when we chatted with Kathy Whitworth, and I sort of described the early days, it just seemed to me, comparing it to the circuses in my youth at Barnstorm throughout the United States.
Absolutely.
And they wore all different hats, didn't they? They had to do everything. They had to sell. They had to set up. They had to do the rules. They had to, the whole thing, right?
Well, there was one story I heard recently that they actually stopped competition because Betsy Rawls was the rules expert. She was playing, and they went and got her out of a grouping, delivered her to where they needed the ruling, and then took her back. That would never happen.
That's amazing. Yeah.
But some great accomplishments, some big personalities. I mean, I think Babe Zaharias is the one that people wish she would have had a longer life because she did so many great things. And I just remember women like Helen Duttweiler, who flew an F-17 Flying Fortress in World War II, for crying out loud.
You talk about Babe, world-class Olympic athlete. They need to be talked about more. I mean, and I was so glad that they've finally gotten some recognition in some theaters when this conversation starts to happen.
Great.
Yeah. Well, let's continue on with your career, Dottie. Bruce mentioned the four wins in 92. In 93, then you went on to win the World Championship of Women's Golf at Naples National. That was a victory by one over Donna Andrews, Meg Mallon, Michelle McGann, and Sherry Steinhauer.
Yeah, I mean, there you go. More great players. That was a very difficult golf course, and still continues to be part of amateur golf for men. Really quality, tough field.
And that was an event founded by Mark McCormick, as I remember.
The World Championship was an IMG-owned event.
Yeah.
Funny, too, when we went in 91, we went to Australia for that championship. Meg Mallon won. I finished second. Meg still doesn't have the trophy. It disappeared somewhere.
Oh, I'll be done.
Yeah, when they shipped it from Australia, still doesn't have it.
That's a shame.
Well, the next year you won the first edition of the Chrysler Plymouth Tournament of Champions at Grand Cypress Resort by two over Nancy Lopez and Lori Mertens.
Yeah, I think you're starting to see a pattern develop here. I played well on hard golf courses, and the Grand Cypress was a hard golf course. Nicholas hadn't kind of softened up the edges of Grand Cypress yet, and it was a beast. I remember the weather being extraordinarily difficult that week, it was an event you worked hard to get into. To be able to be a part of a tournament of champions, you had to win. It wasn't a moneyless thing. It was you had to win to get there. And then to be able to beat everybody in that field, it's not a major, but
feels like one.
It feels like one, yeah, exactly.
Absolutely.
Two more wins in 1995. You won the Ping Welch's Championship in Tucson. That was over, I don't know if she was a relatively newcomer at this time, but Annika Sorenstam and also Cindy Rarick. And then in 95, the McCall's LPGA Classic at Stratton Mountain, by three over Kelly Robbins, which was the final edition of that event.
It was, and that was my local event. It's only an hour and 15 minutes from where I grew up. And I always have often said it was my favorite win on tour because I had so many friends and family in the gallery. And although I won by three over Kelly, I think look at who it was, Pat Bradley, who finished third. And it was really between Pat and I until very late. And it was the Bradleys from Woodstock in Boston versus all the Peppers from around here. And who was in the gallery? One young Keegan Bradley.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting.
That's a neat memory. Well, Bruce, 96 is a pretty good year for this young lady as well.
Oh, boy. Four more victories in 96. You were dominating there in 96, weren't you?
I had a really good run. I think they came within 7 weeks. But nobody really – so I had played very poorly at the beginning of the year. I pulled the ripcord. I pulled out of two tournaments, went back home. I was living in South Carolina at the time. Missed the cut at the Women's Open, one of my missed cuts in majors. And it was at Pine Needles, and I didn't even have a car to get home. I was supposed to – my mother – we had played the Skins game the week before in Dallas. J.C. Penney flew us privately to Pine Needles. Didn't even have my car there. My mom was going to come pick me up. They were living in South Carolina at the time, too, on the weekend. Fine, get a courtesy car, plenty around to get around for the week. I'm going to miss the cut on Friday afternoon, and it's like, this is so pathetic. I can't even go home tonight. I have to wait for my mother to come get me. It was an eye-opener for me that I needed to go back to the basics. And so I went back. I got Mr. Pulver's books out, his letters out, and I did two-a-days. And I played and played and played and hit balls until my hands bled. After pulling out of the next 2 weeks, I needed that time to reset. And then I won in Rochester. I won in Atlantic City. And I ended up winning in Portland. But nobody remembered that 7 week stretch because in the middle of all of that, someone said, "Hello, world." It went straight down the middle. Tiger Woods turned professional.
Thank you for listening to another episode of For the Good of the Game. And please, wherever you listen to your podcast on Apple and Spotify, if you like what you hear, please subscribe, spread the word, and tell your friends. Until we tee it up again, for the good of the game, so long, everybody.
Whack down the fairway. It went smack down the fairway. Then it started to slice just smidge off line. It headed for two, but it bounced off nine. My caddy says, long as you're still in the state, you're okay. Yes, it went straight down the middle, quite a way.